Ramatirthan, glad to be here. My voice comes and goes, so sometimes I get a little help from my friend Narahari. Just the nature of things. So today is the auspicious appearance day of Bhaktivinod Thakur. Now, for me, it's a quite special day for many reasons. One is, if I had to go meet some historical person who I'd never met, the top of my list would be Bhaktivinod Thakur. He is, in modern vernacular, absolutely cool. I mean, who else would be so bold, so brave, and done so much, written 110 books in, I'm not sure how many languages, Sanskrit, Bengali, English, maybe others. When Bhaktivinod Thakur was born, 1838, India, Bengal, was a mess. Practically speaking, the cult of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had been taken over by 11 kind of bogus sampradayas. There were sahajyas, there was mayavadis, there was all kinds of weirdness. It took him 11 years to find a copy of the most important book at the time. What book would that have been? Yeah, 11 years to find a copy. I mean, you know, he couldn't go to Google and find a used copy somewhere. It didn't work well that those days. And the scene in India was, now, who was India ruled by in 1838? No, they weren't. Everyone thinks, not quite. They were ruled by various little kings who the British East India Company. Now, the East India Company was a trading company. And the East India Company co-opted various kings, got their own army, but technically didn't rule India. And so he was born in this situation where there was a comment by one of the British scholars at the time, if you took all the great literature of India, it wouldn't have the wisdom of a children's school book in England. That was 1838, that was said. So when Bhaktivinod Thakur was born, what was worshipped? The cult of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, though it had only been there less than 400 years before, was basically lost. What was worship like in India? A lot of sahajyas and demigods. And Bhaktivinod Thakur, when he was young, from a very wealthy family, he would go to these grand festivals. And there would be fireworks and great events and demigod worship. But the cult of bhakti had basically been lost. And the British were becoming more and more prominent. The British actually took over. Bhaktivinod Thakur was a late teenager. They actually took over. Anybody know what year they took over India? Anybody know what year they actually physically took it over? 1857. In 1857, there was a sepoy mutiny. Sepoys were the soldiers, non-commissioned officers, darker officers, who worked for the lighter officers, the officers who were Englishmen. And at that year, the rumor went around. My research, I can't find out if it was true or not, but here was the rumor. The British introduced a new bullet in the guns. So the sepoys had rifles, and it was a new bullet. And you had to bite off the end of the bullet and then load it in the musket or in the rifle. You had to bite off the end to, for whatever reason, to prime it. And the rumor, and the new bullets, the rumor was they were coated in pig fat and cow fat. And the army was composed of Hindus and Muslims. Well, now they're biting either cow or pig. So you offended everyone. Sometimes we find that somebody is such a good offender. You see them. They come to LA Temple sometimes. They're so good that they know how to offend everyone, not just this person or that person. They're expert. So the British had figured out how to be expert and offended everyone. And so there was a rebellion. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur was in Calcutta during this rebellion. Again, I think maybe he was like 19 years old. So he was wondering what's going on. And the British, there was a British major named Hopkins who was learned all the vernacular languages. So just as a side story, he was able to, British were famous for divide and conquer. So he was able to get certain Rajas to support him and certain Rajas opposed him. And he was able to actually defeat the mutiny, capture the Emperor of Delhi, who was in his 80s, captured him at Amayan's tomb. And when he captured him, the Emperor didn't know he was captured or not because he was so stoned on opium, he wasn't quite sure where he was. So he sent him to exile in Burma. Then his two children, the two princes, the last remaining Mughal rulers, were being taken by this Hopkins back to New Delhi. Anybody know Delhi Gate? Been to Delhi Gate? In New Delhi, it's, you know, big gate. And when he got there, was a crowd of 3,000 people surrounding him. He didn't know what to do. And this all happened in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's life. He was very, very aware of this. It impacted him too. And what did he do? Well, this crowd of 3,000 people, and here he has captured the last successor to the throne. They were mad. They were going to kill him. So he stripped them naked. Because if a Mughal emperor walked naked, it was considered they lost all power. Now, there were some Hindu rajas who walked naked to show they had all power, but that's a different story. But that also happened. But the crowd kept coming, so he shot them. And the crowd dispersed, and India took over, and the crown took over India. I know all of this because the great-great-grandson of the major toured India with me and told me all the stories. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur was brought up in India at this time where it was becoming British, where things, India, were considered lesser. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, by the time he was 21 years old, India had become a crown colony. And parts of India weren't conquered yet, but for all intent and purposes, a crown colony with a capital first in Calcutta, which was started, actually. Calcutta city was started by distant relatives, not so distant relatives of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And then the capital was moved to Lucknow. Meanwhile, Bhaktivinoda Thakur lived in sometimes Nadia, sometimes Puri. And what was his profession? Magistrate. What does that mean in American terms? Sort of, what's the training for it? Lawyer. A lawyer. Like Magendra. Is Magendra here? Yeah. A lawyer. So he became a lawyer. I don't know if they told lawyer jokes in those days or not. Might not have. I know a lot of good ones if you'd like, but that's for another time. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur dealt with modernity. He had a pet. What kind of pet did he have? A dog. What was the name of the dog? Do you know? Anybody know the name of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's dog? Tiger. So he had a dog named Tiger. He dressed according to the robes of a magistrate. And in India, he wanted to become the magistrate in Calcutta. But what happened? That was a huge thing. Why didn't he become the magistrate in Calcutta? Amazing arrangement of Krishna. But you know, he flunked the test. Say again? Yeah, but he tried to pass the test, I think, 3 times. Every other test he would pass. He was brilliant. Brilliant. But Krishna didn't want him to leave Puri. And he, Bhaktivinoda Thakur saw it that way. He saw it. Krishna didn't want me to go on. So, because his family was urging him, you know, higher position. The British liked him. He would go to bed early, get up very early, and finish all his work in a half a day. And he was so efficient and so smart, absolutely brilliant, that he could very quickly dispense with justice. And then there was a lot of sahajyas. There's all these famous stories of him and the sahajyas. What was the name of that one? It slips my mind. Yes. These yogis had some power. Anybody read Radhanath Swami's book? You see, yogis, they get a little mystic power. As in a side story, Prabhupada was once asked, "Do you have any mystic powers?" You might know Prabhupada's answer. He said, "I have the greatest mystic power that any yogi has ever had. No yogi, rare yogis ever get this mystic power." Anybody know what that mystic power was? No, it's more than that. So rare that hardly anybody ever gets it. People are asking him, do you have mystic powers? When I was with Prabhupada, I was thinking, he must have some mystic powers. Because in India, it's kind of cool. You think about mystic powers. Come on, you float, you do this, do that. Prabhupada said, "I have the rarest mystic power of all the yogis. I can be alone in a room full of naked, beautiful women and have no disturbance." The yogis who show their mystic powers, they have ego because they're showing their powers. If they really have mystic powers, they wouldn't be showing them. They're just cultivating for their own inner life. So once they show it, they have ego. Once they have ego, they'll be tempted. So Prabhupada had the rarest of mystic powers, which I think is pretty cool. So back to Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So we have this scene in India where there was no movement then to drive, not no movement, very little movement to drive the British out of India. That came later with Gandhi. At that point, the idea of having a central government in India wasn't such a bad idea. It was such a chaotic scene. Mughal rulers, kings, some kings were corrupt, some kings were decent. But to have some kind of central organized system made sense to a lot of the population. Later on, Prabhupada, he himself, joined the Gandhi movement. Because at that time it no longer made sense. Then Bhaktivinoda's son, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, the Thakur's son, of course, convinced Prabhupada that this whole politics is not very important. I don't think Bhaktisiddhanta said this to Prabhupada, but the essence of how I read it is what people say about Gandhi. According to the saints, Gandhi was a politician, and according to the politicians, Gandhi was a saint. And so Prabhupada started seeing Gandhi more as a saint, and after talking to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he understood it differently. And I think that pithy way is a good summary of how he might have understood it. So one of the best reference books on Bhaktivinoda Thakur is Rupa Vilas's wonderful biography written a long time ago called The Seventh Goswami. Who has read this book? Okay. Very, very well done. He was called the seventh. Why was he called the seventh Goswami? And somebody know? Yeah. Is there a portable microphone so those on TV can hear?
Because because he revived the Chaitanya movement after the six Goswamis had left.
Yeah.
The movement had declined.
And he also did something else the Goswamis did. What else? That's good. He did something else that the Goswamis did. Yes.
He wrote extensively.
That's good. He did good. He did something else the Goswamis did. Very special. Yes. You're on a roll. Keep going.
He revived the Chaitanya's pastimes, the Dham.
He found the holy places. So what the Goswamis do, they rediscover the holy places of Krishna. He discovered Lord Chaitanya. They wrote extensive literatures. They revived the cult of bhakti. So, and very much, he is called the seventh Goswami. I think it's very appropriate. In Bhakti Vinod, he eventually got a transfer to the Navadvipa area. It was very difficult to do. The British didn't want to move him. The British would fight over who he would serve with. And he got sick one time, very, very sick. And maybe he was going to die. And a British doctor sent to him, if he didn't take any medicine and a proper diet, he would die. He had only drinking milk for 45 days. He was so sick. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, from time to time, he said, many obstacles are a good sign. He had many obstacles in his path. Though he was born in a wealthy family, many obstacles came. Maybe he couldn't pass an exam. He got very sick. They had the fight with the yogis who cursed him. And he defeated them. And so many obstacles. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur saw the obstacles always as his arrangement, as the mercy of Krishna. Now, when I first went to India, I went to India as a high school science teacher. Anybody here been to Bihar, India? Okay. Sometimes I give lectures in front of Indians, and I say to them, they say, where were you in India? I say, I was in the most modern, progressive, least political state in India. And they go, where? They're thinking it's their state. And I go, Bihar, and everyone, without exception, starts chuckling and snickering because they know it's sarcasm. It's right next door to Bengal. And there's a lot of caste fighting in that state, huge amount of caste fighting. And so while living there, I was trying to figure out, is Krishna consciousness bona fide? I had read the Bhagavad Gita. I had, not Prabhupada's, hadn't been published yet. And I'd read the Gita, a few Gitas in college, including the one Prabhupada said his disciples could read. I didn't know this, if they didn't read the purports, and that was Dr. Radhakrishnan's purports. When I read it, I, knowing nothing about anything, I thought they were weird. And in that scene, in my own mind, I was trying to reconcile modernity with the ancient wisdom of India. I'm sitting in a state in which I would go to the temples and the mosques and I would ask people, why are you praying here? What are you praying about? What's going on? And what was the answer I got when I asked people why they're praying? What do you think? Excuse me? No, I wish that would have been better. What do you think? Why? Yes. Yeah, even more tangible. Something specific. I want rain. I want dowry. I want money. They treated worship just like we treat Amazon.com. We give them something and they give us something. We place our order, our punya. We go and give our punya order. I give, you know, lock of my hair. I give the money. I give this. I give that. Now I'm waiting for UPS to come with the package. Very much the same mentality we'd have from ordering. The just like to them, to the people I would talk to. And I knew enough Hindi. They knew enough English. We could have conversations. And the people I would talk to, why are you here? They're here to get some. They're here to do a business deal. That's what you do with Amazon, not with God. So I was very disappointed. I said, God, I went all the way around the world. I lived, my teaching assignment was a few hundred rupees a month. I lived extremely austere. Had to face the consequences of drinking sugarcane juice in Delhi without knowing better. And the best I could find spiritually was a business deal. It was a little disappointing, to say the least. Then I received what I consider the blessings of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Because through my whole life, my spiritual life, I felt that the blessings of Bhaktivinoda Thakur have been with me. Somehow, just that relationship. And I ended up running into a devotee who said, why don't you go? We're having a food relief program in Mayapur, right across the river from Bhaktivinoda Thakur's house. So I said, okay, I'll go there, do some food relief. Went there, and then, of course, I met Srila Prabhupada, and he and I had 3 days of extensive conversations, which, what can I say? It doesn't get better than 3 days. Some people ask, well, at that time, wasn't the early days of the movement like in Shyamasundara's book or Yamuna's book, where you just walk in and kind of sit down, hey, Swami, how you doing? It wasn't, you know, like in the early days. And by the way, you have something to eat, Swami? Which those things had. It wasn't like that. It had become a large international society by then. So I figured, how could I be so fortunate to get 3 days of sitting with Prabhupada? I figured it out one day. There were 70 Hare Krishnas had come to the first Mayapur festival. No buildings, just tents. 70 devotees had come. Every one of them was in a great mood to be a preacher. Every last one. And there was only one person to preach to who spoke English. I was the only guest. So Prabhupada kept me with him all day. Then, about 15 years ago, it was today, Bhaktivinoda Thakur's appearance day. And I do environmental consulting. So I was doing some testing, and I had to climb into a pit that's two-thirds as deep as the ceiling of the temple, a very narrow pit to test for something. And I got to the bottom of the pit, and I was leaning hunched over to take a sample, and I felt a weird feeling in my heart. So I stood up, and as I stood up, the wall was collapsing onto me. If I hadn't stood up, 100% chance I'd be dead. There was a crew on the surface, but no one get me out in time. So, and I was fasting that day, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur's appearance day, and I was just thinking the whole time about Bhaktivinoda Thakur, trying to understand how somebody could deal with the whole British and modernity and combine it into a system in which Samadarshana became the most important principle. Didn't matter if you were Hindu, Muslim, British. What mattered didn't matter tradition or culture. What mattered is, can you develop love within your heart? Is it possible to develop love within your heart? And how Bhaktivinoda Thakur epitomized the middle way. Krishna says in the Gita, he says, don't eat too much. What does he say right after that? No, he said, don't eat too little. Don't sleep too much, don't sleep too little. I don't know why in the world we let the Buddhists capture the middle way. The middle way is pure Bhagavad Gita. Pure Bhagavad Gita. So but we let the Buddhists own the middle way. I mean, they're good about it, but Gita is pure middle way. So I was actually thinking about that, really how Bhaktivinoda Thakur transcends, just trying to understand it. Then the wall collapsed, and I think due to the mercy of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I somehow stood up and lived. Yeah, I broke a leg 5 places, but I lived. And then, so Bhaktivinoda Thakur again saved me. Then, some years ago, I was trying to struggle in my own mind. with how is Krishna consciousness, how can I find its relevance in the modern world? We have always this, has anybody here seen Fiddler on the Roof? Okay, I want to point out to all of you people who are going to mundane movies how terrible this is. I'm joking. It's a brilliantly done play, and in it there is the, and it takes place around the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So it takes place in Russia. So it's the Jews of Russia struggling with some of the same issues that the Thakur was dealing with in India at almost exactly the same time. So it's kind of an interesting story. And in it, there is the there's one song called Tradition, in which main character is trying to struggle. His children are like looking for something a little different. But we have to adhere to tradition. How do you balance tradition with modernity? And only great saints can do it. He didn't have the answer. He just struggled with it. Bhaktivinoda Thakur began that combination of modernity with tradition. Revived the Bhakti tradition, presented it in the most modern of ways, in the vernacular languages. It was considered writing in English about devotional topics, according to some of the Brahminical and Vaishnavas, was unacceptable. We don't write in their language. Why should we write in their language? This is our language. Why cast Shastra before swine, kind of thing? And Bhaktivinoda understood that the tradition is the devotion, and the modernity is just how to present it. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, his son, he didn't hesitate to drive in a car, which was considered verboten. He didn't hesitate to dress in Western clothes when appropriate, nor did Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Similarly, Prabhupada came, and he came and he combined the tradition, the essence of the tradition, with how to deal with modernity. Only the greatest of saints can find this combination of the tradition, the essence of the tradition, and how to fit it in the modern world. It's a real challenge. So when I was going through my own struggle, seeing, well, Krishna consciousness, I mean, I love Krishna consciousness, I love the holy name, but I'm just feeling kind of empty. There's just an existential emptiness in me. So I actually read the seventh Goswami book of Bhaktivinoda Thakur at that time. I hadn't read it before. And when I read it, I said, yes, I can now see that my inner struggle, I'm nothing like, my inner struggle was the kind of struggle that Bhaktivinoda Thakur was writing about. He was addressing it. He was talking about it. So then what we've done in Gainesville, which has helped me a lot relate to Bhaktivinoda Thakur and understand, we have most Saturdays a program called Sharanagati Saturday. Now what does Sharanagati mean? Surrender. Now the word surrender is curious, because it doesn't mean surrender like you're Davy Crockett at the Alamo and I give up. Surrender has the meaning in Sanskrit of go forth. It has, surrender is a word we use, it's probably the best English word, but it doesn't quite give the sense of it. Surrender is not just leaning back, but it's going forward to Krishna. So it's a surrender in the sense of going forward. And then, so we do is on Saturday nights, we sing Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Saranagati songs. These songs, if anybody hasn't done it, the experience of studying his songs will do this for you. You will see true, deep, deep humility. How could I waste my life? How could I do this? Yet, you'll see the self-esteem of a realized devotee. But Krishna, I am yours and you have to take me. I'm yours and you have to take me. You have to. And it expresses the most heartfelt sentiments of devotion. So I recommend any temple I go to, if you can have your Sharanagati Saturdays, or you can do Sharanagati Tuesday too, but then you'll lose the alliteration of Sharanagati Saturday. But if you can live without alliterations, any day of the week will do. For me, it so connects me with what is it I want? I mean, I want to understand my relationship with Krishna, and I want to do it in a way that's meaningful to me with the life I live in the world. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was not afraid to live in the world. He wasn't afraid to have a dog named Tiger, if that's what was needed, and he wasn't afraid to deal with the British on their own terms. He wasn't afraid of any of this. And by doing that, he single-handedly revived the cult of Lord Chaitanya. It's hard to imagine, isn't it, that Lord Chaitanya, the incarnation of Krishna, would have appeared 400 years before, and the literature was lost, the devotion was lost, was all messed up. It's hard to imagine. We pray that, you know, when I was a young devotee, Lalit Prasad was still alive. Lalit Prasad was the last surviving son of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati's brother. And I was thinking, how cool. It was an opportunity to see him, but somehow I didn't go. Turns out, I'm glad I didn't, because sometimes he had quite some different opinions than his brother and Prabhupada. So that wasn't for me to venture into. And I was thinking, wow, it's amazing. I never thought that, hey, soon we'll be there. You know, fast forward 40, 50 years, and we're in that situation now where, you know, be soon the last surviving disciple of Prabhupada, the last disciples, I think, of Bhaktisiddhanta. Maybe they've all passed on. Maybe there's one left. I'm not sure. Not sure on that. So the danger is, can we enter another dark ages of Krishna consciousness? And that danger is real. It's a very real danger. If we think it's not real, just imagine Lord Chaitanya, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, was here himself and took very little time to enter it. So the question comes, what can we learn from Bhaktivinoda Thakur? So Prabhupada's mission continues and we don't enter into another dark ages. So with that, I will ask for some opinions from my very, I have some very learned God brothers and God nephews and wonderful devotees here. So what can we learn from Bhaktivinoda Thakur so we don't enter another dark age? We have some ideas. Pass the microphone around, please.
I suppose there's many answers, but one that jumps into my mind immediately is Prabhupada instructed us, don't change anything.
Okay. I always found this to be an interesting instruction, because Prabhupada gave two instructions that are, on the surface, mutually contradictory. They're quite paradoxes, are contradictions that really aren't contradictions. You have to study hard to understand them. Jesus taught in parables and paradoxes, and the whole Shastra is full of it. So what was the opposite instruction Prabhupada gave to that instruction? Don't change anything. Exact opposite.
You can change the details, but not the principles?
That's true. The opposite, I think, is time, place, and circumstance.
Hmm.
So on one hand, Prabhupada said, don't change anything. On the other hand, he said, time, place, circumstance. They're quite contradictory. Hmm. Which prevails? This requires
a little intelligence.
Exactly. A little intelligence. A little intelligence. And I asked Prabhupada one time, what is intelligence? He said, it's knowing things as they are. I mean, it's just understanding reality. So these are the two themes. Bhaktivinod Thakur was particularly adroit at combining these themes of tradition and modernity. And that's what they... Of course, if we get seeped in tradition, we become irrelevant. If we just drop who we are to... like when Prabhupada came to America, what's the first thing they told him to do? Is to, you know, maybe change your diet, or if not, eat with a knife and fork and do this and do that. And Prabhupada didn't hear any of it. But then when the hippies came, he was so criticized by his god brothers. I remember some of these things. So criticized. He let ladies live in his ashram. I mean, I don't think Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati even did that. He initiated ladies. He let ladies in his ashram. Prabhupada understood that in the Western world, the distinction of men and women is much less. And ultimately, our position is nobody's a man, nobody's a woman. He said, once you're a Vaishnav, you're a Vaishnav. We don't make distinctions men, women. Our vision is Samadarshana. Now, when we live in a certain culture, we have to make certain adaptations towards that culture. For example, in Vrindavan, India, Prabhupada told the women, though I don't agree, because the local people are so hung up and we don't want to be a point of controversy, we just have to have men on the altar. He didn't do that any other place in the world. So Prabhupada would balance tradition with modernity for the purpose of advancing devotion. So to create a huge controversy in Vrindavan would not have advanced devotion. To go in the West and make over distinctions between men and women would not have advanced devotion. That was the mood of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, whatever would advance devotion. What else? Any other comments? Any other suggestions of lessons we can learn from Bhaktivinoda Thakur so we don't enter another dark ages? One more lesson. Somebody have a lesson? Gotta have a lesson. Yes. Done.
One of the things that I've had to focus on a lot as years go by is from the second verse of the Nectar of Instruction on the word Niyamagraha. And it seems to fit right now to use that. That's accepting the rules but forgetting the principle behind them or not following the rules. So the sadhana that Prabhupada gave us has perfection in it, but one has to be applying the understanding of what they're for. One's always doing these things to advance in his surrender, advance in his offering to Prabhupada and Krishna. And if he forgets that he's doing that, if he just does the ritual without the feeling and the mood behind it, then Rupa Goswami warns us about this Niyamagraha.
Yeah, well put. And Rupa Goswami's ultimate instruction is simple. Accept those that are favorable and reject those that are unfavorable. Which we find that sometimes one man's food is another man's poison. We can find that too. So Prabhupada had recommended, though I'm not sure if he actually said this. He's quoted this way, but I never found it. But ISKCON is a house that everyone can live in. But he said things like that. And to be that house requires that there's an interest. I'll digress a second. There is a social psychology. I spent a lot of time the last decade studying a different issue. I'll just bring it up briefly. Why is it that, let's say, somebody is on the right politically, and they see absolute evidence that the candidate they're supporting is a lying, conniving snake. I'm not referring to any particular candidate, though I do have one in mind. And when that evidence is presented, there's a certain core group that become a stronger supporter of that candidate. Social psychology has been studying this. And there was a book written by this one Professor Haidt. He was a very liberal, he come from a Jewish liberal family in America, studied at the University of Pennsylvania, and a very egalitarian attitude. And he got a Rhodes Scholarship, a Fulbright Scholarship he got, and he was sent, this was like 15 years ago, and he took an assignment in Orissa, India. And when he got there, he had total cognitive dissonance. He was staying with a host family, and the women would eat after the men. When he would go up to a servant, that was a wealthy family, obviously, and the servants would thank him for something. I mean, servants would give him something. He'd say, thank you. And the family repeatedly had to remind him, we don't do that. We don't thank our servants. And he was seeing red. It was like a bull with a matador's cape in front of him. And he was like the bull. Everything he saw, he just went into a rage. And it took him a month or two to get over the rage and say, okay, this works for these people. Somehow, everyone seems happy in that particular society. It kind of works. And to accept that different people are wired differently, either culturally or our own internal wiring. So then his challenge was, okay, how can people of different persuasions understand each other? And the conclusion he gave was very St. Francis. And St. Francis, also one of my heroes, say, if you want to be understood, what do? Understand. So the conclusion was we really have to understand. When I read a book by this fellow, which related a lot to my experience, because I first went to India, I was just north of Orissa, in a very similar place. I was stone's throw from Orissa, just over the border. And when I had the same issues, my mind was screaming, this ain't right, this isn't right. My mind still screams about it. It's not a value system, that household, that I would ever want in my household. I wouldn't want that. Yet, I understood that what really counts is not that my value system or their value system. What really counts is a transcendence. What really counts is a transcendence. And this is, of course, where this author couldn't go because he's not transcendental. What really counts is what will help me go to Krishna. And Krishna says those who speak this truth of the Gita are what? Nobody's more dear. So what will practically help us share Krishna with people? That is the most important thing. And that is a legacy of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Because Bhaktivinoda Thakur extracted the essence of tradition, revived the bhakti cult, yet he would do anything with modernity, write in another language, dress this way, do whatever it took to share Krishna. So that's kind of where I get my inspiration from Bhaktivinoda Thakur. With that, we're out of time. We'll stop here unless there's one question. Sir, yes, please. Both of them.
Are you sure? Okay, yeah. So you said, what can we learn from Bhaktivinoda Thakur? And I thought to reflect on our preaching and see the results and not just be attached that this is how we have to do it, but actually look and see, are, you know, the Western people in the world, the young people, are they coming? Are they chanting? Are they? And then if it's not working, be open to adjust, not change the principles, but adjust and like just reflect, not be stuck on something.
Thank you. That's good information. And you had a question?
And then the question, you said only pure saints can blend the modernity with tradition, but then also Prabhupada said we have to adjust and use our intelligence. So if we're not pure saints, but Prabhupada wants us to adjust, what's the solution?
Ah, what an intelligent question. Very insightful question. When things really require a lot of, like a total revival, it takes a pure person like Bhaktivinoda Thakur coming to the Western world and figuring out what to do. It requires somebody like Prabhupada. There was one professor, Lonnie Cleaver. He was an interesting fellow. He was Tama Krishna Maharaj's undergraduate mentor at Southern Methodist University when he was there. And Professor Cleaver once made, I thought was a very insightful comment. He says, the problem, he said to Tama Krishna Maharaj, the problem with your guru is not that he said too little what to do, because Tama Krishna was struggling. Prabhupada's gone. Do we do this? Do we do that? What to do? The problem you have to deal with, he said to Tama Krishna, is he said a lot. So that means intelligence. I asked one of the most senior people in the movement this question one time. He's no longer occupies any position. He had left, but he and I are very good friends. And so he looks at ISKCON very friendly from the outside. He just, some personal difficulties had come. So I asked him, I said, what is the most dangerous thing for ISKCON? And he said to me, the most dangerous thing is Prabhupada says. That's the number one biggest danger. Because you can virtually quote Prabhupada to prove any point. What Prabhupada said to me when I sat with him and talked to him about this, he said, you need to apply your intelligence. You need, what Bhaktivinoda Thakur also inspired me, is we need to pray a lot. We really need to go in front of the deities and say, I am bewildered. I'm helpless. Please help me understand. And we need to purify ourselves such that Krishna's telling us in our heart what to do, that we can listen to Krishna, and then we can integrate. I was talking to Vaisheshika recently. Unfortunately, we get to spend a little time together. And so I asked him this question. I said, Vaisheshika, when you deal with certain quotes from Prabhupada's books, there's hardly anybody in the world who really knows Prabhupada's books and appreciates as much as Vaisheshika from San Jose. He just wrote the book on book distribution, Our Family Business. I see several people in the room who are mentioned in that book. A wonderful book. So I said to Vaisheshika, but what do you do with certain quotes? In this case, I'm at Krishna House in Gainesville. We have a center there. We distribute 1,000 plates of prasadam every day. The students love us. Students move into Krishna House for an alternative lifestyle. They're just dedicating, so the plaque goes up next week, a plaque from when Prabhupada spoke there, the first beautiful raised bronze bronze plaque at a major location commemorating Prabhupada in the Western world where he spoke. They're naming where we serve out Krishna lunch. A sign goes up next week, Krishna Lunch Lane. I mean, you know, this is the next step. It's happening in Gainesville. And we have a lot of young people come. And some young people come and they'll read a particular verse from a book. In this case, I was talking to Vaisheshika. There were verses that might not seem complimentary to women. And there's a series of verses that might not seem. There's a series of verses for non-women issues to come up. But in this particular case, one of the young, intelligent women joining Krishna House said, it's just bothering me. So I was with Vaisheshika in Govardhan. Nice place to talk about these things. So I said, Vaisheshika Prabhu, how do you deal with this in your own outreach? And Vaisheshika responded, I have no idea. What am I supposed? No, he didn't say that at all. What he said was, he said, the only way to understand Prabhupada's books, and remember, he's one of the best authorities on how the hermeneutics of understanding Prabhupada's books, the science of understanding it. What he said was, Prabhupada's books are understood in the context. They're not understood sloka by sloka. Even though each sloka on its own can stand alone, and you know, Lord Caitanya spoke on one sloka for how long was that? Weeks or months, I forgot now, a long time. And Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati spoke on one sloka for a long time. But in the context of understanding, you understand it in the context of the whole thing. And this is actually how Shastra works. For example, take Sanskrit. What does the word Atma mean? Somebody tell me. What else it mean? Mind. Body. Which does Atma mean? When I'm reading Atma, which does it mean? Well, when I'm reading a sloka, it has a specific meaning. Sanskrit words are, and I've talked to a Sanskritist about this. Sanskrit words are interpreted within the context of the actual verse or the set of verses. So the meaning can change from, like you say, self to body to soul. And sometimes it's paramatma, but it doesn't say param. There, just atma. So it's understood. The words are understood in context. We have the same thing. If I said to you, the old riddle, what's black and white and red all over? What's black and white and red all over? Can somebody tell me? What's that? A newspaper. Because the word red, there's two different reds. So it's red all over, not the color red. So in a somewhat similar way, Sanskrit words have their own mystery and they're understood in context. Similarly, verses in Sanskrit are also understood in context. The meaning changes with context. Vaisheshika says, when you look at the totality of it, when you look at the context, we're not talking about conversations or anything else. We can add, and Prabhupada's interaction with people. He's talking strictly books alone here. You can really understand it all. It all makes perfect sense when we use our intelligence and look at what's going on in the books. But if we take individual verses or individual Prabhupada says, we can get very lost very quickly, because then we become like, anybody know what a Bible thumper is? A thumper. Bible thumpers. I'll show you a Bible thumper. Bible thumpers. Yeah, anybody heard that term? You'll find the Bible thumpers, especially in states like Tennessee. I used to live in Tennessee at the Murari Sevak Project. And you have Bible thumpers. Here's what a Bible thumper does. And Jesus says, I am the only... Sorry, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. I am the only way. They thump the Bible while quoting a verse. No philosophy, no intelligence, nothing makes sense, and they're thumpers. So we can also have Gita thumpers. Krishna says we can have Gita thumpers just as our Bible thumpers. So... Prabhupada's personal instruction to me was ask a lot of questions. In essence, don't be a Gita thumper. He wrote me a letter. Try to understand from all different angles. So if we see something and it doesn't make sense, that's an opportunity for us to go deeper and understand from different angles. So Prabhupada gave us a lot, and he gave us both sides. So we don't need to reinvent it. We're not going to the new Western world. If we were colonizing Mars and there were Martians there, we may need some great Thakur to help us deal with that. But Prabhupada already came to the West, went all over the world, so it's all settled. Now we just have to use a lot of intelligence. And we can't ever suppress intelligence. Can't say, you're this gender, you're this race, you're this culture, you're less intelligent. I mean, I get this in India sometimes. Oh, you know, even from people in Vaishnav dress. Oh, you're born in Malecha family. How can you possibly know anything? I get that all the time in India. By the way, when did Bhaktivinoda Thakur become a vegetarian? Anybody know? No? No, when did he become vegetarian? At his initiation. I don't know the age. You may be right. I don't recall the age. At his, the day he got initiated. Like I said, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he's amazing. Okay, I'm way over time now. So at this point, yes, Prabhu. So the question is, how do you deal with younger people into other yoga groups? Well, when I first got involved, there was all kinds of yoga groups. And there was all, every week from India, a new guru would come. The New York Daily News centerfold once a week was her joke, who the guru was. You know, Rajneesh and Guru Maharajji and this, that. And, you know, they're all, there were so many then. So I find then it was very rough because everyone was claiming to be God. Now at least the yoga groups, a lot of them are sincere. Our friend Sura does great work with the yoga groups. And Garuda's like become like the scholar of the yoga groups. They're our best friends. Like Prabhupada said, the Indians are our best friends. If we become Hindu, then we're defying the mission Prabhupada gave us. But he said, the Indians are our best friends. They're one step from Krishna, just facing the wrong way. So the Americans, they're 10 steps. But some of them, the young people, are facing the right way. So Indians are our best friends. And so if we help engage the Indians in spreading Lord Chaitanya's movement, it's great. If we become Hindu in the process, guess what? We didn't accomplish anything. Similarly, the yoga groups, they're our best friends. If they're into Gita, if we help them just by being their servant. Listen, we can teach you more about we can introduce a Panjali. We can, you know, help you with Gita. We can help with Kirtan. How can we serve you? If we become the servant of the yoga groups, they're our best friends. If we just said, okay, we're going to start doing, you know, hot yoga, and we're going to heat our temple room up to 110 degrees, and the deities, you know, somebody will fan you, and, you know, then we're kind of giving away. We're going out. Buddhism, mindfulness is brilliant. You can't go anywhere without mindfulness book now. Prabhupada was extremely mindful. The Gita is about being present. The Gita is the mindfulness book. We can share the insights. Gita is talking. Krishna is trying to explain to Arjuna how he can be present. He got on the mental plane. Well, how you can be present, understand who you are and be here. It's the ultimate be here now book. So our only way we can accomplish this is if we are not proud, but we think we're the servants of these people. And somehow or other, we're very fortunate to be connected to Prabhupada, and we can share some of that wisdom in the mood of the servant. If we have that, we're very successful. If we have the mood, we're better than them. They should dress like us, look like us, do like this. This is... Now, if we take the externals as the internals, we're finished. And then everything will be finished, and we have to wait for another Bhaktivinoda Thakur to come. Okay? With that, we'll stop here. I've gone over time. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.